Yeah, I was just waiting for the microphone to work. It's working, so I think that's the signal that it's time for us to get started. We're coordinating several sessions at the same time, and so as people are moving between sessions and they're ending at slightly different times, it's a little harder to know when people are situated. But I think we're fine now. It's 11:25 according to that clock back there. Carl, what official time length do we have here? Originally it was 12, so... Okay, well, let's see what we can do with 25 minutes anyway. And no? All right, so try for the original 50 minutes or whatever it is. All right, okay, you all agree with that? You can wait that long for lunch. Oh, you just skip lunch. That's how we get back on schedule. Okay. Let's have a word of prayer, all right? Father, this morning we're going to talk about some issues that are getting a lot of attention in the culture and in the church today. You know, they're very confusing. It's hard to know exactly where we should stand sometimes. We're not even clear sometimes what the issues are. And I pray that during this next few minutes that we have together, we can get some clarity. We can understand what this thing called postmodernism is supposed to be, how it's supposed to be a good thing for the church, and why it probably isn't. We ask for your help, the help of your Holy Spirit, in the name of Jesus. Amen. I'd like to use as background for the comments that I'm going to make this morning about what I'm calling the myth of postmodern Christianity, a series of texts from the Scriptures, all New Testament passages. I'm not going to be developing this. I'm not preaching. I did that this morning, didn't I? But I'm going to just talk about... couple of things that surface in these passages, and then we're going to go to the topic, and I think you'll see connections, but I won't do a lot to draw those for you. The first passage is in 1 Thessalonians 2:13, and the only thing that's going to prevent us from moving really quickly is that it takes a moment to turn to these passages. 1 Thessalonians 2:13 says, "And we also thank God constantly for this, that when you received the word of God, which you heard from us, you accepted it not as the word of men, but as what it really is, the word of God, which is at work in you believers." Key words, word, believe, accept. Those are key words. Heard and received, then believed. What was heard? What was received? What was believed? The Word of God. In a moment, I'm going to talk about what it means to believe something. And that's going to be really important. Here we just see that something is heard, it's received, and it's believed. It's called the Word of God. Now let's look at Hebrews 4:2. Just a little bit later in the New Testament, Hebrews chapter 4, verse 2 says, "For good news came to us, just as to them, but the message they heard did not benefit them." Why? Because they were not united by faith with those who listened. The words were not united by faith with those who listened. The words didn't get sealed in their hearts because there was no faith. Their reception was different. It's different than what happened with the Thessalonians. So there's a contrast in Hebrews 2 between two individuals, those who heard and whose hearing was united with faith, and those who heard and whose hearing was not united by faith. And that united by faith has a belief component. It's included. It may not be all there is to it, but belief is surely a part of it. Because what is it that they have heard? What is it that they have received? It's called good news or a message. Now, what is news? Well, news is not news unless it's something that's true. Right? I mean, try to think about that for a minute. Is something news if it's not true? It might be rumor. We have other names for things that are presented as if they're news, but it turns out they're not true. Do we still call it news once we know it never happened? No, the news now is that that wasn't true. So now it's true that that wasn't true. That's news. All right? And it's called a message. Now, of course, something can't be news unless it's true. And I don't think the gospel can be good news unless it's true. All right, so now we've got the concept of truth in here and the combination of truth and faith. Let's look at Acts 28, verse 24. Just a number of verses that are of interest here. 28, verse 24. Verse 23, when they had appointed a day for him, they came to him at his lodging in greater numbers. From morning till evening, he expounded to them, testifying to the kingdom of God and trying to convince them about Jesus from both the law of Moses and from the prophets. So Paul is in Rome and he is using the Old Testament to try to convince people about the nature of Jesus. And some were convinced by what he said, but others disbelieved. You see some language in there that's similar to what we've been seeing already. All right, now we've got the attempt to convince. Earlier we had the word is heard, received, believed. Then we've got this dynamic of uniting it with faith, with good news. Now we've got somebody who's trying to convince people. Some are convinced and some aren't. And the ones who aren't convinced, it says, what? Disbelieved. So what do you think the ones who were convinced did? Well, they believed. So if you were convinced, you believed. And if you weren't convinced, you disbelieved. I want to talk about that, what that can mean. Let's look at another one. Romans 1, verse 18. Verse 16 says, I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of man, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God? Known. We've got knowledge here. So we've got belief. We've got reception by means of belief. We've got truth. We've got knowledge of God. What can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. That's a reference to evidence. Doesn't call it evidence. For what can be known about God is plain, for his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and his divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. All right? So here we've got belief, we've got receive, we've got truth, we've got evidence. These are all concepts that are used in Scripture. We could go on down the line. I'll give you some other references and you can look them up on your own. Romans 3, verses 2 through 3, where it speaks of the oracles of God. Romans 4, 21, where it speaks of having full assurance. What is that? 2 Thessalonians 2, 11. If we go back to Hebrews 3:12, skip up to verses 16 and 19, then go up to 11, verse 6, then go to 31. 1 John 5, 10 and 12, Revelation 21, 8. If you want to go to the Gospels, you've got Mark 6 and 6, John 5, 47, all sorts of things in John, etc., etc. Now, what am I getting at? There is a constant theme in Scripture that the Gospel has something to do with things to be believed that are supposed to be true and that are supported by evidence. Now, I believe that. I believe that that is generally how we live our lives anyway. We are naturally interested in truth. We are truth inquisitive by nature. That's what I think. We are truth inquisitive by nature. And that's because we feel a dependence on truth to organize our lives, to order our lives, to have our lives go right, to turn out well. Let me take very simple examples. You're standing on a busy street corner. It's in downtown Seattle. And there's all sorts of traffic, and there's all sorts of noise, and there's people everywhere. And you're trying to decide, is it safe now to cross the street? You want to get over, maybe you're going to go to the market down on Pike, right? And you're going to, you know, shop around and buy some fish or whatever. And to do that, you've got to cross this busy street. So you have a goal, and you want to accomplish that goal, and you want to be alive in the process, right? So you step off that curb, but only after you have concluded that it's safe to do so. And the basis for doing that is the evidence that you have. Now, you don't always think about it that way. You don't think about, okay, before I can safely cross the street with real conviction, I have to have what I think is a true belief that it's now safe, and for that I need evidence, so I'm going to collect evidence, and then I'm going to decide what to do. That's not how it works. The reasoning process, the act of collecting evidence and acting on what we collected is very natural. It's something we do instinctually. And we're very well rehearsed. We practice this all the time. We don't have to think about it all that much. We do this when we drive. You know, you can have this experience when you're driving. I don't know if you've ever had this experience where maybe you're pulling out of a parking lot into a busy street, or you're getting ready to do a U-turn or turn left. It's, you know, more than just kind of cruising along, minding your own business. You're actually taking some special action. And your head tells you everything's fine, right? You've looked every direction. You're paying attention to traffic lights. You understand the laws. All this is part of your consciousness, and you're acting. And you think, I've got to be doing something that's okay and safe. But you get this kind of uncanny feeling like, ooh, I just wonder if there's something else I'm not noticing in my environment. Have you ever had that happen? That can happen in lots of different situations. But generally, we just kind of move about in our environment and we're fine. What we don't notice is that we are interested in getting the truth so we can act responsibly, and that to do that, we depend upon having evidence. Right? Evidence that generally is adequate for those purposes. Now, we do this in the routine of our lives. Sometimes, though, we have to do this more conscientiously, more deliberatively, more reflectively, because it's a different kind of situation. And there are times when we really do wonder, what should we believe? What should I believe about something? And we don't just automatically think, well, it's obvious because here's the evidence for it. We don't just have a reflex that's part of an unconscious processing of evidence. It's just not always that easy. So we think about it, and we are deliberate in gathering evidence. Okay? And sometimes we have a good idea about where to go for evidence, and sometimes we're not even sure where to look for evidence. We don't know what's a reliable source. And then we don't know what to do when we've got evidence for and evidence against, and how to blend these and figure out, you know, what is most likely true. But that's what we do. And that's how we're designed to function, by God. I think it's partly because we're created in the image of God, and we have minds, we have consciousness, we're capable of reflection. I was out on the beach yesterday in Port Townsend, all these rocks on the beach, you know, and there's an interesting kind of design. There's a pattern in the pebbles lying there. They're smooth in certain ways. There's a kind of continuity. Each one's different. But as you look at the beach, there's a kind of pattern, and there's some beauty about it. But though there's a kind of design appearance there, there's nothing conscious going on there. These rocks didn't arrange themselves in that pattern, right? Well, that's obvious. I think it's the same with trees, to be honest with you. I don't think trees do a lot of reflecting, right? Now, this is the state of Washington, and you know, you've got to be real careful about how you step on the toes of the trees, or at least the tree lovers, right? And then you've got other animals, and these are arranged in different hierarchical fashion. The fish are maybe not quite as sharp as the chickens. They're certainly not as sharp as the dog. Maybe the dog is not as sharp as the orca. Maybe the orca is not as sharp as the dolphin. And, you know, I don't know what to say about elephants. They're very forgetful. You know, that sort of thing. But do they have human consciousness? our experience with animals suggests that whatever consciousness they have, if they have it, is different than ours. And if they deliberate, they don't deliberate in the ways we do and about the same things we do. I don't think they contemplate the purpose of their existence. I don't think they do. My dog doesn't seem to. He shows other behavior that suggests things are going on, mental kinds of things are going on. But, you know, he's limited. And I don't think he worries about immortality or whether his behavior is morally acceptable. Some of it seems to me isn't. But then I realize, well, this is a dog. How could that be morally inappropriate? You know, he just doesn't deliberate about the things I do. He respects me. I like that. Shows some poor judgment on his part sometimes. You know how you can treat your dog? He just keeps coming back. He's very faithful. My goal in life is to be the kind of person my dog thinks I am. We got some dog lovers here, right? I've seen the dogs. Got the Rotties, right? And they're just faithful animals. Their awareness is different than ours. Ours ranges over a lot more things, a lot more complex things that we care about that they don't care about. We were meant to care for those things. It's uncomfortable. You know, it's hard to get closure on the big questions. Is there a God? If there is, what's God like? If there is, what's my relationship to Him? How am I related to Him? Am I responsible to God in any way? What's the point of human existence? What happens when I die? Is there an afterlife? If so, is there anything I can do to prepare for it? Is it just whatever happens, happens? Do I need to know to be prepared? Anything special? There are a lot of things that happen in the world I don't like. Suffering. I call it evil, but is it? Or is it just stuff that happens? Is there a reason for it? Does it make sense? Is there some compensating good that justifies it? These are our questions. And this is not quite like, will it be safe to cross the street? These are more important questions, where getting it right is actually much more critical, and having good evidence for what you believe about those things is, in parallel fashion, just as critical. And yet, we live in a day when people are saying, evidence, shmevidence. Who needs it? Now, this is supposed to be about postmodernism. Talk about postmodernism. How does it relate? Well, it relates very closely in this respect. Today, a typical postmodern attitude is one of being fairly casual about truth and evidence. But there's a dirty little secret here that I think needs exposure. And that is, it's casual about belief, which is actually unavoidable. Now let me explain. I said that we are truth inquisitive, and we are by nature evidence gatherers, right? We do it consciously sometimes, we do it unconsciously. That's our nature. And we have beliefs. We are the kinds of things that believe things. And the things we believe are called propositions. I teach philosophy, so I'm going to now introduce some language that gets used in my discipline. And the reason why I'm going to use it and try to explain it is because it's convenient once you understand it, to be able to talk with this language. So we call these things propositions, these things we believe. Propositions are related to states of affairs, ways things can be. Now, the way things are, or ways that things are ways things can be, right? I mean, if they weren't ways they could be, then they wouldn't be ways things are. Something can only be if it is possible for it to be. Right? So you've got a state of affairs. It's either actual or possible. So right now I'm here speaking at Crossroads Bible Church for a conference co-hosted with Antioch Bible Church. on Christian apologetics talking about postmodernism. That is a state of affairs that's actual. Here's another state of affairs. I am right now, right, doing the backstroke in our swimming pool in Southern California while my dog is barking at the neighbor's lawnmower. Well, now, that state of affairs is possible but not actual. Now, the dog may be barking at the guy who's mowing his lawn. I don't know about that. That might actually be going on. But I know I'm not doing the backstroke in my pool right now. I don't even do that very often. I probably wouldn't be doing it anyway if I was home. Right? But that's a possible state of affairs. We could be meeting in a different room, but the same people, same topic. That would be a different state of affairs. Okay? Possible, not actual. Okay, a proposition then it pertains to a state of affairs. And it can be expressed in a sentence in a natural language. That's what we call any language that's spoken, like French, German, English, Swahili by some people, and so on, right? Greek. So you can say in English what propositions mean that stand for states of affairs. And that's what I've been doing when I talked about different states of affairs that are actual and possible. I talked about doing the backstroke in my pool. I was using English to do that. Guyvet is now doing the backstroke in his pool. That's a statement that expresses a proposition that pertains to a state of affairs that's not actual. Now, if that was actual, then it would be expressing a proposition that's true, because the state of affairs that it pertains to is actual. So, for every state of affairs, there's a corresponding proposition, and when that state of affairs is actual, it obtains, the proposition is true, and when the state of affairs does not obtain, the proposition is false. It's that simple. And so you have a true proposition when what it is about or what it is of, that state of affairs actually obtains. In other words, it corresponds to the way things really are or reality. That's when a proposition is true, and it's false under all other circumstances, because under all other circumstances, the states of affairs themselves do not obtain. They're not actual. All right. So propositions then can be expressed in languages like English. And so we can say, the sky is blue. And if it's blue, if that state of affairs to which we refer in making that statement, well then, if it's blue, it's true. But if it's not blue, it's not true. And you can say the same thing about anything else that counts as a proposition. Right? True, false. So what makes a statement of a proposition true or false is the state of affairs that it's about. We don't make things true or false by believing them. They are true or false depending on how things actually are in the world, that part of the world that they happen to be about. Now, I can make some propositions true by believing them, because I can say, I am now thinking of the proposition that I am now thinking, or something like that. And by thinking about it, I can make it true, right? But that's an atypical case. In most cases, we're talking about propositions whose truth depends not at all on anybody else's consciousness, awareness, belief, anything like that. All right? Now, to be truth inquisitive, then, is to want to have true beliefs. That is to say, to believe propositions that are true and not to believe propositions that are false. That's our goal. We call this our epistemic aim, because we like to use fancy words in philosophy. Episteme comes from Greek for episteme, meaning knowledge. And our epistemic aim as knowledge seekers is to have true beliefs and no false beliefs. You might say, all true beliefs and no false beliefs. I mean, maybe you would think that the ideal would be to believe everything that's true, all propositions that are true, and disbelieve all propositions that are false. Good luck. Two problems with that. First of all, it's not feasible. You'll fail. And second, it's not really worthwhile. There are a lot of truths you really shouldn't bother about, that you really shouldn't care that much about. I mean, do you really care how many fleas there are on the carpet in this room? I mean, really, maybe now that I mentioned that there's a possibility of it, you care, you're looking around. Okay. Now, you know how many elephants there are in this room, right? How many? Right. But do you care? I mean, if there are, they're not bothering us, right? Now, so here's an interesting question. If I want to know how many elephants there are in the room, it's easy to find out, right? I know what to do if I want to know what's true. I know what to do if I want to know what's true. That's worth writing down because it rhymes. All right? I know that all I have to do is kind of look around because I know what elephants look like and I know what evidence for them would be. It would all I have to do, I don't have to get out of my chair. I don't have to look under the chair, right? I don't have to ask my neighbor. I've got all it takes just by looking around. But if I want to know how many fleas there are, I might know what I'd have to do, but I wouldn't have any inclination to do it because it's trivial. There's a true proposition. It might be zero or it might be 10 or it might be some unfathomable number, which if you actually knew would suddenly make you care. But right now it doesn't matter to you, right? You're not thinking about that. And that's the thing. We don't really care to believe everything that's true. That's not that important to us. And you know what? A few false beliefs, if they're innocuous, that's not a big deal either. I mean, false beliefs about how many fleas there are? Who's going to know? What difference does it make to my life? I'm still going to, you know, do my business and, you know, do the other things that matter. So you see, we want to have true beliefs and not have false beliefs, but primarily with respect to the things that matter most. That's where it counts, with respect to the things that matter most. So that's why we come back to these other questions. Is there a God? What's the point of a human existence? Why is there evil in the world? What's morally right? What's morally wrong? What makes my life, you know, meaningful, significant, etc.? What happens when I die? Does anything happen? Can I prepare? Blah, 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 blah. Those are things, that's a little different than like, well, are there fleas in the room? Okay. That's not trivial. We want to have true beliefs about those kinds of things. Do we know what to do if we want to know what to believe? That's the question. Do we know what to do if we want to know what to believe? You hear the question? Well, we know the general answer is look at the evidence. Okay, how do you do that? What is that? But you know what? Some people are saying, evidence? Some evidence. Nah, that's not what it's about. People aren't wired that way. They don't care about reasons to believe things. That's from the Enlightenment period. I almost said the pre-Enlightened era. You know, during the Enlightenment era, right, and the era of science and the hegemony of science where it just takes over everything. If you want to know anything, you got to know it the way scientists know it. Everything else was pre-Enlightenment. Ugh. You know. Well, now we kind of got past that. So now we say, with disdain in our voice, oh, evidence, reasons, all that stuff? Oh, that's just the Enlightenment stuff. That's for people who want to be enlightened. It starts to sound a little weird when you put it like that, right? And the reason why they say that's a problem, in effect, for people who want to be enlightened is because that's not a realistic prospect. There's no hope for that. We're not able, really, to be enlightened. You know what we can do? Is we can tell stories. We can talk to each other about pictures of the world. We can say, this is the way I think of things. How do you think of things? Oh, that's interesting. That's different than my way of thinking things. Congratulations. Well, shall we have drinks? You know, settle that. The comparison now is just in detail of positions and differences, but there's no issue of, you know, what do you believe? It's more a matter of, you know, what's the story of your life and what sort of story is reflected in the choices that you now make? It's about story. It's not about belief. And see, when it's not about belief anymore, enlightenment concerns are sort of not part of the picture anymore. It's more about who's got the best story. Not the correct story, the best story. That's kind of like, what was the best movie you've ever seen? Or the best novel you ever read? What's the best story, right, for a human life? Have you ever been told? Now, a lot of Christians fall for this because they say, oh, well, we know what that is, right? It's the Christian story. It's the story of how God came to rescue us from peril through Jesus Christ. And you got the details. You got all the scriptures laying out the narrative of the story. The problem is, we're using story there differently than postmoderns are. We're saying something about how things really are. And we're saying it's a story because there's a coherence to it. It's got a goal, right? There is movement towards a climax. There's anticlimax. It has a lot of the elements of story. And story is very compelling. But it's compelling for the sake of believing what's true. But when you strip that goal of story from story, all you've got is story. And so today, people don't talk about what should we believe. They talk about what narrative do you find preferable. So now I want to go back to these concepts of truth, belief, and evidence just for a moment and then tie them in with the concept of narrative to help you understand what postmodernism is as I understand it myself, as I see it. We're truth inquisitive, and when we want to believe what's true, the only thing we've really got to go on is evidence. To believe something is just to hold that it's true. That's a very simple way of saying what it means to believe something. There's more that we could talk about, you know, what belief is, what kind of mental state it is, and so on. How does it compare with desire and things like that? But just very simply, a belief is a matter of holding. It's a mental state where you hold a proposition to be true. You consider some possible state of affairs to be actual. That's belief. And you have lots of beliefs. That's just unavoidable. All right? But now, you're not neutral about whether these beliefs are true, because to believe them is to hold that they're true. Right? So you can't really be neutral about their truth value if you believe them. By the way, truth value is another fancy phrase that we use, right? It just means that propositions have truth values, and there are two values that they can have, but they can't have both at the same time. A proposition is either true or it's false. Those are the values, true, false. And so when we ask what's the truth value of some proposition P, where P stands for that proposition, we're saying is that proposition true or is it false? Now, when you believe a proposition, you've taken a stand. It is true. That's what it means to believe it. You can't say, well, I'm neutral about the truth value of my beliefs. That makes no sense. You are not neutral about the truth value of things you believe. Things you believe are things you take to be true. That's your conviction. You're not neutral. Now, you might be neutral about some propositions because you don't believe anything about them or because you're not sure what to believe. You don't believe they're true. You don't believe they're false. You're somehow agnostic. That's fine. You can be neutral when that's the case, but you cannot be neutral about the things you believe. Because to believe them is to hold that they're true. Now, there's a kind of odd thing about this, is that one of the things I believe, I can believe and do actually believe, is that some of my beliefs are false. I believe I have some false beliefs. And this is when Carl and some of the other organizers, you think, oh my gosh, did we get the right guy? I mean, maybe we should send this guy home. You know, he's going to tell us what they are. Now, see, that would be a problem. For me to stand up here and say, I've got false beliefs is one thing. For me to say, now let me give you some examples. That'd be a problem, wouldn't it? Because if I said, well, here's something I believe, but it's false. Well, I thought if you believed it, it was a matter of taking it to be true. How can you be saying it's false? It doesn't work. Well, then how can I believe I have false beliefs? Because I've got good evidence that I have false beliefs, because I've had false beliefs before, you know, that I don't believe anymore, but I'm not so sure I've done all the weeding out that I need to do. Right? So maybe I don't know what they are, but I suspect there are some, right? If I could get myself to believe on the actual number of fleas in the room right now, I would probably be wrong. But it would be hard to get myself to believe something about that because I've got no evidence. That's how sensitive to evidence we really are when we believe things. We can't just cause ourselves to believe things. Try it. Let's say you believe right now that there is an elephant on the platform behind me. Just do it right now. Just believe that. Can you do it? Can you imagine it? Oh, yeah. Well, you can imagine. That's different. You can imagine an elephant. We're all imagining different elephants, right? Now, some people actually see elephants when there aren't elephants. They're pink. They float. But that's usually after, you know, beverages of a certain sort. I'm talking about ordinary perceptual experience. Now you're going to just say, I'm going to start believing something I didn't believe a moment ago. I'm going to believe there's an elephant on the platform. You can't do it. Now, if you looked and you had evidence that there was an elephant up there, well, then you probably wouldn't be able to resist believing it. We're that sensitive to evidence when we believe the things we do. That's why we need to be conscientious in our handling of the evidence, because if we're not, some things will attract our attention. We'll take that to be good evidence when we haven't weighed the counter evidence, and we'll just believe it sort of without effort. And that can be very dangerous if what we're believing is not true and it matters. It's about something very important. And unfortunately, we've got sleepwalkers in the world today who are just going along believing what seems right without real inquiry, without any investigation. It just seems right to them. They couldn't even tell you why it seems right to them. That's what everybody says. I sat on the airplane with a young girl. She's like just out of college, or maybe she's still in college. And she was very articulate, and she was talking to me about how in her home there were two different religious traditions, Christian and Muslim. You know, Dad was a Muslim, Mom was a Christian. And she thought that, you know, religions were all kind of going in the same direction. Well, you can imagine. And so I asked her a few questions, and I didn't go after her real hard, but we had a good conversation. And I thought she was an exceptionally thoughtful person, given the conversation I had with a lot of other people. And yet still, it seemed to me that she was comfortable, satisfied, when she shouldn't have been as satisfied as she was, with the kind of evidence that she really was working with. You know what I'm saying? When you're talking about something that significant, why would you be satisfied with very thin, very minimal evidence? And so many people are today. So you see, they have beliefs about these things, and they believe based on evidence that they're sensitive to, but the evidence they have is just really bad. It's like, well, that's what everybody else thinks, you know? Or, I don't know, what are the alternatives? So, now, there are things we want to believe, right? Whether we should believe them or not. Sometimes what we desire isn't true and isn't very well supported by the evidence. And this can make things even more complicated, because now, not only am I sort of casual and lazy about gathering evidence, but I really don't even want that to be true. So I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going there. It's a lot more comfortable for me right now to just believe this, right? And we now live in a culture where this kind of mentality is being encouraged, reinforced, and managed. And it's really dangerous on every level. It's dangerous politically. It's definitely dangerous religiously and spiritually. And what's going on? What's going on is that people are disillusioned with the possibility of believing with knowledge that something is true. They're disillusioned with that prospect. And so they think that even with hard work, it's not possible to get it. Not that they've tried. And so we don't try. And now what we do is we talk about our goals a new way. It's no longer about true beliefs based on evidence. Now it's about stories that we tell each other and whether or not we like those stories. So, to believe something is to hold that it's true. But now the question is, why would you believe something? You see, you can't believe something but say, but my view is it's false. We already established that. But now, whenever somebody says, I believe something, which is actually increasingly rare, right? Do you believe this? Well, I don't know. It always depends on something. Okay, tell me what it depends on and tell me what you believe. Right? If it depends on that, what would you believe if that was the case? You know, you try to get down to bedrock belief. Everybody's got belief. Then the question is, the natural question is, but why do you believe that? Why? Why? Well, that's a problem. How am I going to answer that? And The question isn't a causal question. It's not explain what caused you to believe it. No, it's a reasons question. It's asking what are your reasons? What good reasons do you have for thinking that it's true? I'm not asking for a causal explanation of how you happen to have that belief in your mind. I'm asking for a rational explanation, what we call an epistemic explanation, for why you think the proposition is true. Well, I didn't say that. No, but you said you believed it. That's what it means. Okay, so you see, you can get going in a circle here unless you stay focused. If you've got beliefs, it's because you take these things, these propositions to be true. Now the question is, should you? Why do you? And if there's no reason to, then the question is really poignant. Why would you bother believing something if you had no good reason to believe it? Well, maybe I don't believe it. Well, maybe not. So how does it function for you? How it functions for me now is not as a belief anymore. It's as something that works for me. It's comfortable. It's convenient. Now, this is going to get real technical, and then I'm going to back off, and I'm going to open it up for a few questions. In my discipline in epistemology, we talk about what ultimately justifies beliefs and how that works. And one view is called foundationalism. Foundationalism. Foundationalism holds that beliefs that are justified are of two kinds. There are beliefs that are justified on the basis of other things that are believed. So if you've got certain justified beliefs, they're, you know, well justified, you've got good reason to believe that they're true, then that can support other things you believe by means of inference. You can infer from those things you believe other things that you should believe. Okay? So that's one kind of justification, is justification that comes from beliefs being based on other beliefs that are justified. But another kind is basic, where now the justification doesn't come from other beliefs you have, but from your experience with or acquaintance with what your beliefs are about. So when I look at this sheet of paper and I believe that it's yellow, that's not because I'm making inferences from other things I'm believing. I'm just directly aware of the color of the paper as yellow, and I believe it. So the justification I have is grounded in my experience with that object. It's not a belief that's grounding it. It's the experience that's grounding it. Now, that experience can cause me to believe various things. I can have other experiences that give me grounds for believing things. And then I can take those things I believe as grounds for believing other things, and that's going to be reason, that's going to be inference. So I have two kinds of beliefs, or two kinds of justified beliefs, those that are justified because they're based on other beliefs, and those that are justified without being based on other beliefs, but through acquaintance with the world. Now, foundationalists think that's the way it's got to be, or you're not going to have justified beliefs at all. How so? Because if you just have beliefs that are justified because they're based on other justified beliefs, the question now is, well, what justifies those beliefs? Well, the story goes, they have to be justified based on other beliefs that are, well, justified. Okay, fine. Well, what justifies those? Well, you get a regress going, and it never ends. And you need a terminus to the regress, or you're not going to have justified beliefs at all. You see how that works? So there's got to be a stopping point, and that's going to be grounded in experience. So experience is going to have to be rich enough to arm you with justified beliefs that can then be the basis for believing lots of other things. Now this, I think, is not only the true picture, but it's how God made us. We are fearfully and wonderfully made, and you can find out part of what that means by doing philosophy, believe it or not. Now, an alternative to that is called coherentism. The coherentists looked at the foundationalists, they said, well, I don't think we can take that all that seriously because, this is one reason, we're not so sure how justification in the basic way is supposed to work. It seems to us that if anything's justified, it's going to have to be based on something else that is itself justified. And you can't talk about a justified experience or object in the world. You can only talk about a justified belief. So the justification has got to come from a belief. Now, that's kind of a simplistic way of describing the problem. It gets deeper than that, but there are ways to respond. But I want to tell you a quick story. Coherentists believe that in order for a belief to be justified, it has to be based on other beliefs, and so your beliefs have all got to be part of a network of beliefs that are consistent and cohere with each other in order for any of them to be justified. And if they relate to each other in a nice, coherent, tight nexus, described in whatever way you think is necessary, then you'll have justified beliefs. Now, one consequence of this is that two different people can believe completely different things, and as long as what they believe is coherent within itself, what they believe is justified for them. Now, it doesn't mean it's true, but it means that from their point of view, that's what's most likely true, and they're right to think that. So you can have incompatible systems of belief that are both justified. That's one problem. A second problem that's related to that is, how does this person talk to this person about what's true? And what motive, what incentive could this person over here possibly have for listening to an argument that this guy has when he's already got a perfectly self-consistent system? Right? So interest in truth begins to kind of lose its traction for us, and that's not humanly realistic. So that's a problem. But now here's another problem. It doesn't seem like justification can really come that way after all, because ultimately, the beliefs that we have about objects external to ourselves, like physical objects in the outside world, beliefs about other people, their mental states, what they're thinking, what they're talking about, what they report to me, those are all beliefs I have. Those are all things I have beliefs about, but they're external to my consciousness. All right? Now, my beliefs are about those things, but my beliefs are in my mind. And the coherentist thinks that my beliefs in my mind are justified as long as the beliefs themselves relate to each other in the right way, which means those beliefs don't have to relate to the outside world any way at all to be justified. So justification can come even when the beliefs don't have any special relationship to what they're about. This is like the Achilles heel of coherentism. You've so internalized justification now, you're not even talking about what the belief is about anymore. Just for the sake of justification, you're making that something that doesn't depend on what the beliefs are about. All right? So now you just completely disconnected yourself from the world, and this is called the isolation problem for coherentism. Because now you've insulated your system of beliefs as coherent from whatever it is they happen to be about, which should make a difference to whether they're justified. But they can't, because it's a matter of internal consistency. Oh. Well, some people figured this out and said, we got a problem. And Houston said, you got two options. You can go back to foundationalism, or you can drop the whole project of justification together. Just kick it out of the, just get rid of it. How do you do that? Here's how you do it. Let's stick with coherentism as a way to think about our commitments intellectually, our mental commitments. But let's not worry about whether they're justified. Not really justified, but it is important to us that they cohere. They do need to cohere, or else we're not going to be able to live that way. You've got to have beliefs that cohere, or else you won't have a life that coheres, right? So it can't just be a whole bunch of random propositions jammed together, oh, I believe those, and now you're going to go live that way. No, your life is going to have to be shaped and formed by a coherent story, right? A plausible story that's plausible just internally. But it doesn't really matter if it's true anymore, because that's not the concern. The concern isn't for justified belief. That's only a concern if you care about what's true. The concern now is that I've got a coherent system out of which I can live my life. Are you hearing me? This is what's happened. So now we say, okay, it's not about justification anymore. As soon as it's not just about justification anymore, it is no longer about truth. Because truth is only a matter of interest to us for the sake of getting, justification is only a matter of interest to us for the sake of believing what's true. The only reason why I want justified beliefs is because that's the only base I have for thinking that anything's true. If I let go of justification, truth goes away with it. So there goes my truth interestedness. You know what else goes away? Belief. How so? Because belief is a matter of taking something to be true. So you drop justification, right? You lose truth. You lose belief. What do you got left? Story. What you've got left is a narrative. A storyline for your life. And if it's comfortable, if it works for you, maybe that's good enough. You see, if you want to believe what's true, then you've got to care about justification, and that becomes a matter of evidence. But you see, if you don't care about justification anymore, then evidence is irrelevant. So now, what makes the difference? Why would you choose one story or one narrative over another? You see, if you're going to choose one system of belief over another, it's going to be because you want to know what's true, you need evidence. But if that's not important anymore, you just want to pick a story out of many options, what's your criterion? Well, you can figure out what the criterion is by watching television during commercials. That's how it works. It's advertising. It's rhetoric, but not evidence. So you see a beautiful car, and you think, yeah, I'd like to have one of those. And this beautiful girl that's draped along the hood or whatever it is, you know, has no bearing on the plausibility of owning one of those things. But somehow it's, you know, motivates you, and you're drawn to that. Advertising works not by appealing to reason and evidence and justification for believing that what they're offering you is really worthy, but by just getting you to buy. So how do you get buy-in on story? Not by giving reasons, not by giving evidence. No, that is counterproductive because some stories are just plain irrational. There's no good evidence for them. They're counter-evidential. You shouldn't believe them if you care about truth. So how are we going to convince people to believe them anyway? Don't worry about getting them to believe. Don't try to convince them to believe it. Just try to get them to live that way. You see? And so now you've got a lifestyle without belief. Wow, that's convenient. You know, you get all you want, no accountability. And people, that's what I think is the central thing about postmodernity. Now, do I have to spell out to you what's mythological about that from a Christian point of view? Doesn't the question, is there a myth here of Christian postmodernity, sort of answer itself? Remember the verses we looked at? We've got heard, received, believed. This is good news. These are the oracles of God, right? Truth is what we talk about here, right? How can you accommodate that conception of the gospel to a postmodern view of the world? It can't be done. If I'm right about what happens to truth, belief, and evidence on a postmodern conception of what we do when we, quote, believe things. Right? So I actually think that when you're talking to people, it can be a little frustrating when you ask them what they believe and they talk the language of belief when maybe it's not really belief anymore. The kind of attachment that we have to propositions is no longer belief. So there are two different kinds of attachments you can have to a proposition. One is belief or some cognate, some related attachment. You can believe a proposition or disbelieve it, or you can withhold judgment because you're not sure what to believe. The evidence is sort of counterbalanced. You're agnostic. Okay, I call those doxastic attitudes because that's what they're called in philosophy. And the word doxa comes from belief. It's Greek for belief. And so they are belief-like attitudes. They have to do with belief policies. They're doxastic commitments to believe it, to deny it, to withhold. Those are all doxastic commitments. The postmodernist says, we don't need those anymore. We have commitments to propositions, but they're not doxastic. We don't believe them. We don't deny them. We don't withhold judgment. That's not our project. What's your project? Well, our commitment is to accept propositions that provide the kind of coherence for our lives that we want it to provide. And so now you can kind of choose, pick and choose. And the criteria for picking and choosing among stories has nothing to do with what would justify or not some belief. It's just a matter of personal preference, pragmatics, and so on. And so now the way you get buy-in is you've got a belief system, not a belief system, but a story, a narrative that you want for yourself, but you can't live that without getting people to participate with you because it's just not going to work, right? How would you like to be the only Christian in the world? What would it be like to try to live the Christian life if you're the only one? That'd be hard going. What if you were the only atheist in the world? You got a problem. If you're the only, you know, environmentalist in the world, very hard, you know, to protect the environment by yourself, right? So what people do when they've got this driving enthusiasm for a story is they try to get people to buy into it with them because that's how it worked. That's needed for it to work just for them. And so now persuasion is not a matter of reasoning about evidence. It's a matter of political maneuvering and advertising. That's all it's about. I don't see how we can accommodate the gospel to that conception of what it means to be a fully flourishing person made in the image of God, truth interested, and naturally oriented to be sensitive to evidence. Postmodern Christianity is a myth. So who believes it? Real quick story. I don't think we have a lot of time to have questions. Quick story. I was invited. The reason why I got drawn to this discussion is twofold. One is I teach epistemology, a whole branch of philosophy that deals with issues of knowledge and justification. So I have to deal with it there. But the reason why I got drawn into it more at this level, doing apologetics, interacting with people in the church, is because I was invited by a guy a couple of years ago to participate in a book project where they were going to have Christians talk about Christianity and the postmodern turn, that is, this development of postmodern mentality in the world. And he wanted to know if I would come in, and you know, he knew I was a foundationalist, and I would defend that view. But he found other Christians who were postmodern in their own way. And so we have this tension in the book, right? So I've got two chapters, and everybody else, each person has two chapters. In the first chapter, we make our statement. In the second chapter, we kind of pick at the other guys. Nobody gets a chance to respond to the criticisms because there wasn't room in the book. But that's the background to what happened last fall. I was at a conference of the Evangelical Theological Society in November in Pennsylvania, and there was a panel arranged based on this book, so some of us who contributed the book were on the panel together. And so here I was, the only foundationalist on the panel. There was another guy who was kind of somewhere in between foundationalism and something. I wasn't really sure. And then there was a third guy who was more or less a postmodernist, but somehow Christian too. At one point, somebody in the audience asked him, "So, what do you think truth is? You know, what sort of thing is truth?" And he said, "Well, we have to make a distinction between truth as such and then truth with quotation marks around it." Right? And truth is how things, you know, are, of course, but truth with quotation marks is just our approximation to it, which is never going to be, you know, really accurate. And these are really distinct things. There's truth, and then there's truth with quotation marks. So I made sure I got a chance to respond to that. So the first thing I said was, I'm having problems with quotation marks here, because in all the postmodern literature, quotation marks are used all over the place. And I don't know what they stand for anymore. Everything's put in quotation marks, which means, well, it doesn't mean what you think it means. Well, tell me what it's supposed to mean. Because when you put quotation marks around truth, all that says is, oh, I'm using the word truth, but don't think it means what you think it means. Well, I want to know what you think it means. So I said, let me ask you this. Your statement that we divide between these, that there's truth without quotation marks and there's truth with quotation marks, is itself a statement, something that you believe, it's a conviction you have. Let me ask you, I take it if you believe it, it's true. I want to know, is it true in this sense, or is it true with quotation marks around it? You know what he said? It's true with quotation marks around it. Okay, well then what does it mean? Right? See, the jig is up. Postmodern Christianity, people, is not only a myth, it really is a dangerous myth. Because we play party to the whole casual attitude about truth and good reasons to believe it. We got nothing to worry about. It is a naturalistic world out there that has every reason in the world to say, evidence? Shmevidence. Why? Because we've got evidence on our side. What are you going to do if the evidence is so strong that the only way you can resist what it implies is by discounting the value of evidence. I think that's where we're at today. All right. Now, I apologize. I'm not even sure where we're at with time, to be honest with you. Carl, I defer to you on that. I take it we're done. Take a couple quick questions. All right. You had your hand up first. Yes. Ah, well, great question. Now, see, this is what happens. I get pulled into these things, too, because I wrote something on... The question is this postmodern view the foundation of what's called the emerging church? And, again, this is what happens to me. The media people at Biola University asked me if I'd review a book by Brian McLaren, prominent emerging church leader. He's written a whole bunch of books. One of them's called A Generous Orthodoxy. So I think it's published by Zondervan, I can't remember. They said, would you review this book? You know, could you, you know, let us meet with you, interview you, whatever, write a review, and we'll put it in our Biola Connections magazine, which goes out to our alumni. I said I would do it, but I don't even have the book. I can't do it for you, sorry. They said, oh, that's not a problem. We'll just send you the book. So okay. So I thought, well, I need to read it anyway. I might as well review it. So I did a little review. Well, then somebody writes me and says, hey, I like the review. Let's do a book on the emerging church. This is what happens. And here's why I'm tempted to do it. Because I do think there is a connection. There is a connection. Brian McLaren's concept of a generous orthodoxy is a beautiful illustration of what I was saying when I said persuasion is no longer a matter of providing evidence to believe something to be true. It's more political. Why? Think about the term orthodoxy. What does it mean? It means, basically, true belief. Orthodoxy. True belief. All right? Now, orthodoxy for Christianity gets entrenched in its early tradition and then built on as long as it's consistent with the early tradition, right? So orthodoxy is this thing that lasts and lasts and lasts and has a history. So what is a generous orthodoxy? Well, it's something new. Now, new orthodoxy is itself a kind of contradiction in terms. But a generous orthodoxy is new in the following respect. Now what we do is we find ways to blend things that have tended to keep people apart. So now you can be evangelical and liberal. You can be Eastern Orthodox and whatever else. And what he does, he has all these chapters throughout his book where he takes what he likes from the different things and says, let's make that part of the blend that's going to be called a generous orthodoxy. But he doesn't give arguments for these things. He just says, we'll all get along better if we do this, and we will make a better impression on the world if we put our differences aside and show that we can do this. But now the we turns out to be some radically odd, well, frankly, bed partners. It just seems like they couldn't possibly go together. And I would ask him, the first question I would ask Brian McLaren, if I ever had a chance, is I would say, let's take the Da Vinci Code just as a way to precise the question. I would say, all right, so where do you draw the line in your generous orthodoxy? How do you circumscribe it so that you let all the stuff in that you want in, but you leave the stuff out that you don't? What's your criterion? Can you say that the perspective represented by, say, Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code about the early origins of Christianity, can you say, well, we can have that too? Now, here's the problem. He's got a dilemma. If he says no, then I'm not sure he's consistent. If he says yes, then he's got to tell me what his criterion is. And I don't see how he's going to have one unless it really does matter what's true, and then that's going to come back to, well, then what makes us think that's true and not this? That's evidence. And he wants to say, but evidence, argument, that drives a wedge, that's divisive, we need to get rid of that. We shouldn't have such a preoccupation with that. We need to love each other. Well, he's right about that. But we need to do it with the spirit of truth. We're out of time. I'm sorry. We'll talk. Take one more? We're out of time. I'm not going to apologize because I'm not allowed to.